Good evening and welcome to Allowed at the Aratani. Pleasure to see you all here tonight. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Allowed series, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which is your presenter tonight in cooperation, co-presented by the Japanese Cultural and Community Center. We're very, very pleased to be here again with our second Nobel laureate, if I do say so myself. We also want to thank the Levantine Center for their help in getting the word out on this, and we're just very pleased to have you all here tonight. If you don't know what the Library Foundation is, please pick up a brochure. It does wondrous things for the Los Angeles Public Library, makes possible literacy programs for adults, which is so crucial in these times, teen programs, children's programs, and the Allowed series at the Central Library. So please pick up a brochure and consider becoming a member. We really, really appreciate it. Let us imagine that we are in Istanbul, looking out on the Bosphorus, the Sea of Marmara, and the Golden Horn. That is where we're going to travel tonight in the work of the great writer Orhan Pamuk, who, quote, in the quest for the melancholic soul of his native city, as the Nobel Literature Committee wrote, has discovered new symbols for the clash and interlacings of culture. Or as Pico Iyer wrote in his review of Pamuk's wonderful new novel, The Museum of Innocence, by drilling with such intensity and obsession into every corner of his country's insecurities, he has given voice to nearly every society in the world, torn between the longing to be global and to be itself. Orhan Pamuk is the author of 6 novels and the recipient of many major Turkish and international literary awards, including, of course, the 2006 Nobel Prize for Literature, the first ever awarded to a Turkish citizen. He is one of Europe's most prominent novelists, and his work has been translated into more than 50 languages. His books include The White Castle, The Black Book, The New Life, My Name is Red, Snow, Istanbul, Memories of a City, Other Colors, Essays, and a Story, and The Museum of Innocence. He is currently the Robert Yikfong Tang Professor in the Humanities at Columbia University. Those of you who read the Sunday New York Times Magazine, perhaps some of you here, piece on Pamuk, know that he's actually opening his own museum of his own idiosyncratic collection in his beloved home city of Istanbul. Among the objects, 4,213 cigarette butts, 237 hair barrettes, 419 national lottery tickets, and one quince grinder, a remarkably beautiful object, which I really covet. These objects are imprinted with memories, lives lived, collected by a novelist in love with memory itself. Tonight, Mr. Pamuk will read from his new work, and then he will be joined in conversation by Reza Aslan, an internationally acclaimed writer and a scholar of religions. Born in Iran, Reza is currently assistant professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside. His most recent book is How to Win a Cosmic War. And next fall, Norton will publish Words Without Borders, an anthology, which he edited, of contemporary fiction, nonfiction, and poetry from the Middle East with works translated from Turkish, Arabic, Persian, Urdu, Dari, Hindi, and Hebrew. And then after their conversation, we'll open it up to you. We have microphones in both sides of the room. We'll ask that you line up. We'll have time for some questions. And then afterwards, both authors will be signing their books in the lobby, which are for sale tonight, courtesy of the library store. It gives me great pleasure. It is a deep honor to please join me in welcoming Orhan Pamuk to the stage. Thank you.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I will be reading from my Museum of Innocence, which is actually a love novel, and or a novel of love. So that's how the publishers put it. But then, when I was writing this, I was constantly thinking about the other major love novels or novels of love, and thinking, what is my originality? Am I saying anything different from others? And I was also consoling myself that, yes, I am, perhaps, that this is a novel about love, but it's not putting love on a pedestal and saying how sweet it is, what a wonderful thing love is. My attitude to love is not that. I try to be more detached, understand love as a very humane thing, and tell honestly, what happens, especially to a man when he is deeply in love? the thought process, what happens to his spirit, how some part of his mind thinks this way and the other part thinks that way, the inevitability of it, consolations, visions, so forth and so on. A sort of an anthology of our reactions, especially man's reactions to love. Let me read one little, very brief page about, for example, love pain. This is a first-person singular narrative voice. The main hero, Kemal, is, after 30 years had passed, is now telling us how it felt when he was in love, and it takes the form of a sort of a pain, what we call love pain. The deepest pain was initially felt in the upper left-hand quadrant of my stomach. As the pain increased, it would radiate to the cavity between my lungs and my stomach. At that point, its abdominal presence would no longer be confined to the left side, having spread to the right, feeling rather as if a hot poker or a screwdriver were twisting into me. It was as if first my stomach and then my entire abdomen were filling up with acid, as if sticky, red-hot little starfish were attaching themselves to my organs. As the pain grew more pervasive and intense, I would feel it climb into my forehead, over the back of my neck, my shoulders, my entire body, even invading my dreams to take a smothering hold of me. Sometimes a star of pain would form centered on my navel, shooting shafts of acid to my throat and my mouth, and I feared it would throttle me. If I hit the wall with my hand or did a few calisthenics or otherwise pushed myself as an athlete does, I could briefly block the pain, but at its most muted, I could still feel it like an intravenous drip entering my bloodstream. And it was always there in my stomach. That was its epicenter. Here maybe I'm influenced by Istanbul earthquake. Despite all its tangible manifestations, I knew that the pain emanated from my mind, from my soul. But even so, I could not bring myself to cleanse my mind and deliver myself from it. Inexperienced in such feelings, I was like a proud young officer ambushed in his first command, forced into a mental rout. And it only made matters worse that I had hope with every new day, new dreams, new reasons that Fisun, his beloved, might appear at Merhamet Apartments. That was where they have met, in fact, and made love, which, by making the agony bearable, prolonged it. This is how he feels. In fact, when I've published this in Turkey, there were two popular reactions to the book. Women were smiling and said, Orhan Bey, Mr. Pamuk, are you like Kemal? Kiki, kiki, kiki. And they were smiling. While men were not smiling, but saying, yeah, it's sad, but you know, it's so bad, I couldn't read it. Then he finds some consolation, some ways of getting rid of the pain. This is chapter 41. We are in somehow one-third of the book. Swimming on my back. To be sure, those painful September days had their dark beauty, and as the month wore on, I discovered an important new way of making them bearable. If I swam on my back, the pain would ease. To make this happen, I had to throw my head very far back to the point where I could see all the way to the bottom of the Bosphorus, but upside down, and I had to carry on swimming in this attitude for some time without coming up for air. As I backstroked through the current and the waves, I would open my eyes to see the inverted Bosphorus change in colors, fading into a blackness that awakened me to a vastness altogether different from the boundless pain of love, offering me a glimpse of a world without end. Because the Bosphorus is so deep, so close to the shore, there were times when I could see the bottom and times I couldn't. But to glimpse this brilliantly colored realm, albeit upside down, was to see a great mysterious hall at whose sight one could not but rejoice to be alive, humbled at the thought of being part of something greater. Gazing down at the rusty cans, the bottle caps, the gaping mussels, and even ghosts of ancient ships, I would contemplate the vastness of history and time and my own insignificance. At times like these, I would notice that I could enjoy concentrating on my love and being absorbed by it. Exposed and grieving even more deeply, I could cleanse my soul. What mattered was not my pain, but my connections with this mysterious infinity shimmering beneath me. As the waters of the Bosphorus poured into my mouth, my throat, my ears, my nostrils, I could tell that jinns inside me, governing equilibrium and happiness, were well pleased. A sort of sea drunkenness would overtake me as I propelled myself backward, stroke after stroke, until there was no pain in my stomach at all. I would feel a deep compassion for Fisun, his beloved, welling up inside me at that same moment, and this reminded me of how much anger I felt too. Seeing me racing backwards towards a Soviet oil tanker or a city line ferry, anxiously tooting its horn, Sibel, he is engaged actually to someone else, would jump up and down on the shore, frantically calling to me, but most of the time I would not hear her cries. In this habit of swimming so dangerously close to the steady procession of city line ferries, international oil tankers, cargo ships laden down with coal, passenger boats, and barges distributing beer and meltem to the Bosphorus restaurants, almost as a challenge to those vessels, great and small, Sibel. So an unhealthy impulse, and in her heart, she wanted me to stop bobbing backward in the Bosphorus in front of the house, but knowing what good it did chasing away the pain, she didn't insist. So this is the novel is a vast panorama of Istanbul, its culture, between 1975 and end of 20th century. The events takes place mostly between 1975 and 85. The novel has also cultural qualities, is about sexual repression, the subject of taboo of virginity, so forth and so on. But one of the things narrator, my main hero, does is to go, he's an upper class, sometimes he refers to himself high society guy, who he now retreats in himself and leaves his upper class position and begins to lead a solitary life and goes to back streets of the city because now that he had lost his beloved, he wants to be alone, like a wounded animal. So here he is talking in love, and the love and the beloved is lost, walking in the back streets of Istanbul. As I scoured every neighborhood, every street of the city, it never crossed my mind that I would recall the hours I spent hunting for her as happy ones. When Füsun's ghost, now this is this book is also about how lover behaves, a sort of an anthology of lover's reactions, seeing her ghost, now that she's not around, he sees her ghost or her vision. He thinks that, oh, it's for 5 seconds, 3 seconds, oh, it's her. Then realizing it's not her. When Füsun's ghosts began to appear in the poor neighborhoods of all of the old city, Vefa, Zeyrek, Fatih, Koca Mustafa Paşa. These are old, conservative and poor neighborhoods of Istanbul. I concentrated on that side of the Golden Horn. I would be driving through their narrow back streets, smoking a cigarette as the car rumbled over the cobblestones and potholes, and suddenly Füsun's ghost would dash out in front of me, impelling me to park the car at once and luxuriate in a deep affection for her beautiful and impoverished neighborhood. With all my heart, I would bless these streets with their tired aunties in headscarves and young toughs staring at the strangers roaming in the neighborhood in search of the ghosts and the old people and the unemployed idling in the coffee houses, reading newspapers in air thick with coal smoke. When a careful study of an apparition in the distance proved it was not Füsun, I would not leave the neighborhood right away. Rather, I would continue wandering around, convinced by some irrational logic that if a double had appeared here, the true Füsun must be close at hand. And so I came upon a broken marble fountain, 220 years old, sitting in the middle of a cat-infested square, and the sight of slogans and death threats scratched on every visible surface scrawled by factions of the various left and right-wing parties brought me no disquiet. With my heart convinced that Füsun was somewhere nearby, these streets were for me enchanted. I resolved that I needed to spend more time walking through these streets, more time in these coffee houses, drinking tea, gazing out of the window and waiting for her to walk by, but that if I was to get closer to her and her family, I needed also to live more like them. Shortly thereafter, I stopped frequenting the newest restaurants of Nişantaşı and Bebek. I lost interest in the society amusements that had once consumed my nights. I had already tired of meeting up every evening with Mehmet, who saw it as our common fate to spend hours discussing what our girls were buying in Paris. Even if I managed to shake him off, Mehmet would track me down at whatever club I went to afterward, and his eyes shining, he would go on and on what about what Nurcihan had said to him that day on the phone. When Sibel rang me, I would panic, for I had nothing to say to her. There were times, I admit, when I longed for the consolation of Sibel's embrace, but I was so guilt-ridden, so worn down by my evil duplicity, that ultimately her absence was a comfort. Relieved of the pretenses that our situation demanded, you understand, he is engaged to someone else, I became convinced that I had returned to my old self. As my old self, though troubled, I would wander through the city's old neighborhoods looking for Füsun, cursing myself for having neglected to seek out these charming streets, these old neighborhoods, much sooner. And I regretted not having broken off with Sibel before our engagement, or not finding a way to break off the engagement afterward before it got to be too late. The novel has also, as you see, melodramatical qualities, everything. But then also, it's also, there is a lot of irony, humor. I worked in Turkish film industry around the year that I married to make some money. And I worked for a Turkish film producer for a movie that was, for a script that was never made a movie. But then I was 30, and then this guy who was almost a generation older than me would take me to the bars, to the Turkish Hollywood, which was only a street, Yeşilçam, and to the places that was interesting but also confusing for me. And with all this experience, I used some of this experience in the book. Some picture of Turkish film industry, Turkish Hollywood, Turkish Yeşilçam, its films, its melodramas, and the whole novel is also a sort of a counterpoint to this subject. So here, at last, now that our hero, who had lost physically his beloved, finally finds her, but now she is, just like in a melodrama, is married to someone else. The three of them, his beloved, her new husband, and our upper class narrator, who is deeply in love, go to Turkish movies, and they're also planning to make her a movie star. From the middle of June 1976 to the beginning of October, we went to see more than 50 films at the summer cinemas. Toward nightfall, I would go with Çetin, the driver, to the house in Çukurcuma to collect Füsun and her husband in the Chevrolet, just as I had done on evenings when we went out to eat along the Bosphorus. In the morning, Feridun would, the beloved's husband now, Feridun would have discovered from managers and distributors he knew where the film we wished to see was showing, noting the neighborhood and the district on a piece of paper, and under his direction, we would try to find our way. Istanbul had grown wildly over the previous 10 years, while fires and new buildings had changed its face, and the narrow streets were packed with fresh arrivals that we often lost our way. Only by frequently stopping to ask directions did we eventually find the cinema, and even then we were obliged to run, often arriving to find the garden already in darkness, and so we would have no idea what sort of place it was until the lights came on during the five-minute intermissions. In Turkish movies, and still it is in Turkey, that when you see a film, there is a five-minute intermission, so you have to go and buy soda or whatever. In later years, these cinema gardens would disappear. The mulberry and plane trees would be chopped down, replaced with apartment buildings or turned into parking lots or mini football fields covered with astroturf. But in those days, each time I set eyes on these mournful places surrounded by whitewashed walls, little factories, tattering old wooden houses, and two or three-story apartments with too many balconies and windows to count, I was shocked by how crowded they were. Intermingled in my mind with the drama on the screen was the lively humanity I sense in all these big families, the mothers in their headscarves, the chain-smoking fathers, the soda-sipping children, the single men, the barely suppressed fidgetiness of these people munching disconsolately on their pumpkin seeds as we watched the film, always, almost always a melodrama. During a film's most affecting scenes, we would hear nothing but a rustling noise coming from the hundreds of people seated around us, munching pumpkin seeds. Parentheses, the first time I heard this, I thought it was coming from some machine in a nearby factory. Whenever I heard this sound, I felt as if we had all been abandoned to sorrows gathering up within us for many years. But the film's ambiance, the jostling of people who had come out to have a bit of fun, the wisecrackers in the section for the single man at the front, and of course, the implausible plot elements all hindered my ability to let myself go and luxuriate in my suppressed fears. When Orhan Gencebay, a very famous Turkish movie star and a singer, told his sweetheart, "May happiness be yours and may the memories be mine," someone at the front yelled, "You fool," but almost no one laughed approval. We were all silent. That was when it occurred to me that the lesson this country had learned or yearned to learn above all others, the skill we must wanted to master and pass along, was that of gracefully accepting defeat. The film had been shot in Bosphorus Mansion, and perhaps because it awakened memories of last summer and last autumn, For a brief time, I felt a lump in my throat. Just off the coast of the Dragos, a white ship was slowly advancing across the Sea of Marmara toward the sparkling lights of the Princess Islands, where happy people were summering. Lighting a cigarette, I crossed my legs and gazed at the stars, dazzled by the beauty of the universe. I had been drawn into this film, coarse as it was, by the audience's hushed response. If I had been watching the film at home alone on television, it would not have affected me so. And had I been sitting with my mother, I would not have watched it to the end. It was only because I was sitting next to Fisun that I felt the bond of fellowship with the rest of the audience. When the lights went up, we were as quiet as the mothers and fathers bearing sleeping children in their arms. Not once did we break this silence on our return journey. As Fisun dozed in the back seat, her head resting on her husband's chest, I smoked a cigarette and gazed through the window at the somber streets, the little factories, the shanty towns, the youths defacing walls with leftist slogans under cover of darkness, the trees that looked so much older at night, the aimless packs of dogs, and the tea gardens about to close, while Feridun whispered to me his good-natured analysis of the film's key moments, which I never once turned my head to acknowledge. One warm evening, we went to the Yeni İpek Cinema, located in a long and narrow garden squeezed between the shanties near Ihlamur Palace and the back streets of Nişantaşı, where we sat under the mulberry trees to watch The Agony of Love Ends with Death, and a second melodrama, Listen to My Crying Heart, featuring the child star Papatya. As we sat holding our soft drinks during the intermission, Feridun mentioned that the tough guy with the thin mustache playing the crooked accountant in the first film was a friend of his and was willing to play a similar role in our film. This was the point I realized it would be very difficult for me to enter Yeşilçam, Turkish Hollywood, Yeşilçam film world purely for the sake of being close to Füsun. So now they enter Yeşilçam, Turkish film bars that I had also entered in mid-80s. So with the most onset of winter, Feridun, Füsun, and I delayed not a moment in visiting the backstreet hounds, the prospective production offices, and the coffee houses where second-class actors, would-be film stars, bit players, and set workers played cards, as well as the bars where producers, directors, and semi-famous actors were usually to be found from early evening, eating and drinking until the late hours. All these places were a 10-minute walk up the hill, and whenever I took this route, I would remember how Aunt Nesibe had told me that Feridun had married Füsun. Feridun is his beloved's husband, and Aunt Nesibe, her mother. Aunt Nesibe had told me that Feridun had married Füsun in order to live within a walking distance of such establishments. Some evenings, I would collect them at the door, and some evenings, we three, Feridun with Füsun on his arm, and I would walk together up to Beyoğlu, having had our supper with her parents. Our most frequent destination was the Pelur Bar, popular with film stars and men with new money, hoping to mingle with girls who hoped to become starlets and the children of Anatolian landowners, now cast into the Istanbul business world by day and letting off steam in the evening, and moderately renowned journalists, film critics, and gossip columnists. All winter long, we met many actors who played supporting roles in the films we'd seen that summer, including that mustached friend of Feridun's, who had played the crooked accountant,
and we become part of that society of spirited, bitter, but ever hopeful souls who whiled away the evenings exchanging vicious gossip, recounting their life stories and describing their ideas for films, and who couldn't get through a day without the company of those like them. They were very fond of Feridun, and because he held some of them in high esteem, he had assisted some others and wanted to ingratiate himself with the rest, he would go off to their tables, sitting with them for hours, leaving Fesun and me alone, true never happily on my part. When Feridun was with us, Fesun would address me as Cousin Kemal, only very rarely dropping this half-innocent pretense. If she did deign to speak to me sincerely, I read her change of register as a warning about the man who came and went from our table and her future life in the film world that I ignored at my peril. One evening, after too much rakı, I found myself left alone with her again, and having tired of her aspirational fantasies and the pettiness of this milieu, I suddenly became convinced of the rightness of my next command and of her receptiveness to it. Take my arm, darling. Let's get up and leave this dreadful place together right now, I said. We could go to Paris or Patagonia, to the other end of the world. It doesn't matter so long as we forget all these people and live happily ever after, just the two of us. Cousin Kemal, how can you even say such a thing? Our lives are what they have become, said Füsun. After we'd been coming to the bar for several months, the drunken lot that gathered there every night, parentheses, and it crowd and their own minds, didn't bother us, having accepted Füsun as the young and beautiful bride and having pegged me with derisive suspicion as the well-meaning idiot millionaire who wanted to make an art film. But there were inevitably those who didn't know us, or drunks who knew us but leered at Füsun anyway, or who had caught a glimpse of her from a distance while bar hopping, or who nurtured an irrepressible longing to narrate their own life stories. This was an enormous crowd, and collectively, they hardly left us alone. While I enjoyed it when a stranger joined us with a glass of rakı in his hand, having taken me for Füsun's husband, she would straightaway smile and correct them with an insistence that broke my heart every time, saying, "My husband is the fatso over there," and emboldened the stranger to ignore me and attempt to make a pass at her. Every attempt took a different form. Some claimed they were looking for a, quote, dark-haired, innocent-looking Turkish beauty, just like her, to use in a photoroman. Some would immediately offer her the lead in some new film on the prophet Abraham, headed imminently into production. Some would gaze longingly into her eyes for hours, saying nothing, while others would discourse on life's little beauties and all the subtle wonders that no one paused to notice in this materialistic world, where only money mattered. Then there were the ones who sat at remote tables reading the work of long-suffering imprisoned poets, poems about love, longing, and the nation. Others from distant tables would either pay our tab or send us a plate of fruit. By the end of the winter, we were frequenting these Beyoğlu hounds less, but every time we did go, we would inevitably see the same great hulking woman who often played the diabolical prison matron of or the leading villainous bulky sidekick. She would invite Füsun to dance parties at her house, promising quote, lots of cultivated, well-schooled girls like her. And there was always an old, squat little critic who wore bow ties and girded his enormous belly with suspenders. He would plant his ugly hand like a scorpion on Füsun's shoulder, foretelling the great fame awaiting her, perhaps as the first Turkish actress to gain international renown, provided she gave careful consideration to every step she took. Füsun would indeed give serious consideration to each and every film, photoroman, and modeling offer, however unsuitable or trivial. She would also remember the names of everyone she met, and in the case of film actors, no matter how obscure, she would shower them with outsized, even vulgar compliments. A want of proportion that I couldn't help tracing back to her days as a shop girl. Even as she tried to flatter and beguile everyone, she was also determined to achieve the often contradictory purpose of making herself seem interesting. Maybe this is all. Shall I continue? Maybe I'll read a bit more. In a few years' time, I would discover that most of the actors we had befriended in Pelur Bar were also working in the domestic porn industry. And this startled me as if I discovered that all my friends belonged to a secret society. Well-mannered, middle-aged actresses and actors of strong types like Salih Bey would get by dubbing foreign films that were only moderately obscene. And during the sex scenes, moaning and screaming to suggest the details of the action that the film didn't show. Most of these actors were married with children and admired for their gravitas. They would tell their friends that they had been forced to take on such work during the economical decline so as not to be entirely cut off from the film world, though at first they hid it from everyone and especially their families. Even so, their ardent fans, particularly those in the provinces, would recognize their voices and write them letters of hatred or admiration. At the same time, far bolder, greedier actors and producers, most of them regulars at Pelur, were involved in domestic productions that must go down in history as, quote, the first Islamic porn films. The love scenes in their films mixed sex with slapstick as the gasping and moaning proceeded with ludicrous exaggeration as the actors assumed all the positions that could be learned from European sex manuals brought on the black market, though all involved, male and female alike, would never remove their underpants. Maybe that's enough.